Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Welcome to the October edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with James Mitchell Crowe, Phil Broadwit, Bibiana Camposeo, and Tom Bond. I'm Meera Senthilingam from thenakedscientist.com. In this month's show, we explore some deadly scents.
They want to create a chemical profile for death so that they can ultimately design a device that can be carried to disaster sites to discover bodies and then identify how long they've been dead for.
Sniffing out a crime scene. Bibi Camposeo will be explaining how researchers have identified the scents of death, as well as how this will make crime scene investigations more efficient. Also on the way, it may give you smelly breath, but garlic is the godfather of the spices.
Garlic contains a group of thiocyanates, and it turns out that it has got multifaceted attributes. It certainly is also antibactericide, reduces your cholesterol, improves your digestion, the anti-cancer agent. The lists are infinite in terms of its potential.
Jaya Henry will be revealing the health benefits of his top three spices, as well as garlic, shortly. We've also got a new, greener design for batteries.
Well, these are metal-free rechargeable batteries, and as you say, they're made largely from paper. And the advantage that they have over current batteries is they can be made extremely thin, and they can also be made flexible.
James Mitchell Crowe will be explaining just how this paper-thin battery will work later in the show. That's all coming up on this month's Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Now, first this month, we imagine going out to a crime scene. A body's been found, but no one knows how long it's been there. Currently, it's difficult to work this out whilst out on location. But now, it may be slightly easier, thanks to a new device that could sniff out the different stages of decomposition. Does this really work, Bibi?
Yes. It happens that dogs that are searching for human remains in disaster sites might be soon out of a job, because a couple of researchers at Pennsylvania State University are trying to identify the chemical composition of death. They basically have used pigs because pigs replicate the five stages of decomposition of bodies that humans go through. Basically, they euthanize the pigs, and then they try to collect the volatile organic compounds that are released during the early stages of decomposition. They want to create a chemical profile for death so that they can ultimately design a device that can be carried to disaster sites or whatever and help to discover bodies and then identify how long they've been dead for.
So what materials were they using to collect the volatile organic compounds?
They're using solid phase microextraction fibers. They have three different types of fibers with polymer coatings on the outside, and these are placed over the carcass of the pig within a wooden enclosure that allows airflow, I should say that. And then these fibers, they are taken regularly back to the lab on ice to avoid the loss of any volatile compounds. And then they analyze directly into a GC-MS apparatus. And they have so far worked on the first 2 weeks from the death of the pig, and they have created chemical profiles. And using these three different types of fibers, they have demonstrated that the chemical profile is virtually identical and is quite accurate in that they see, you know, the same chemicals appearing every time within the same concentration. Other techniques are a lot more complicated in that they require different type of equipment that needs to have vacuum or some sort of pumping system to draw the air through the collection material. They're going for some sort of crime scene investigation sort of device that they can carry and do the analysis in situ. So hopefully it should all be pretty straightforward and very easy. So.
And well, from rotting flesh, now over to cancerous cells, Phil, as it seems that antioxidants aren't quite as beneficial as we all think.
Well, yes. There's a lot of discussion about whether antioxidants prevent cancer or perhaps maybe at certain stages aren't so useful. And what Joan Brugge at Harvard has been looking at is the very early stages of cancer. Now, normal cells have to be attached to a sort of scaffolding matrix that provides them with certain nutrients as signaling compounds. And as cancer cells divide very quickly, they soon run out of room to be attached to the matrix. So if you think of a cancer tumour, the cells in the middle of that aren't going to be attached to that matrix. So they need to develop a way of surviving away from that.
The fact that they do this, has the body come up with various ways to attack them then and kill them?
Yes, well, there are two major defence mechanisms. The first is programmed cell death or apoptosis, but a lot of cancers have evolved ways of turning that process off. And the second process is that reactive oxygen species, which are very oxidising and help to break down lots of the proteins and molecules in the cell, which cause it to die.
So how do the cancerous cells then overcome these natural defence mechanisms?
Well, there are two problems. The first is this genetic apoptosis, which they've quite happily turned off using various genes. The second is getting energy. One of the main things that being attached to the matrix does is allow them to transport glucose as a source of energy into the cells. If you're not attached to the matrix, that glucose transport mechanism is turned off. So they either need to find another way of getting glucose, which can be done using various genes, or they need to find a different source of energy. And that different source of energy could be the oxidation of fatty acids.
So how would they obtain this energy from fatty acids?
That's where the antioxidants come in. There's a problem with fatty acid oxidation in these cells that have been detached. When the cells are detached, they start producing reactive oxygen species as the secondary defence mechanism to try and kill the cell. That also blocks fatty acid oxidation. If you then add antioxidants into that, you can neutralise the reactive oxygen species and allow the cell to get its energy from fatty acid oxidation.
So basically the presence of antioxidants at this early stage of tumour formation is allowing the cells to proliferate because it's allowing them to get energy from fatty acid metabolism.
Yep, that's exactly right.
So now knowing this, what can be done to understand more about tumour formation and hopefully prevent tumour spread?
It's crucial that we understand how the metabolism and chemistry that's going on within cancer cells changes through their lifetime. We know that established cancer cells don't use fatty acids as a form of energy because they spend a lot of energy making fatty acids. Fatty acids accumulate in cancer cells. But it seems that in this very early stage, just when the cells detach from the scaffolding around them, that they are using this as a sort of interim source of energy. Understanding that will hopefully help us understand where we can intervene in that process and stop the cancer from spreading.
So understanding this use of antioxidants in the early stages of cancer cell proliferation could help stop the cancer in its tracks. Thanks, Phil. Now, the pollution of our environment and the warming of our planet have been issues that we've been aware of and trying to deal with for a long time now. And the main culprit we all seem to be worrying about is carbon dioxide, or CO2. But there's another element that's been causing damage whilst in the shadows of CO2, and that's nitrogen. James Galloway from the University of Virginia has been trying to bring the trouble nitrogen is causing out into the light to show that this too is a major environmental concern.
The current concern regarding nitrogen is that there is too much in the environment. As a background, let me say that nitrogen is very common in the environment, but it's in a form that is not reactive. It's in the form of the molecule N2, two nitrogen atoms put together. And it's not biologically reactive, mostly chemically or physically reactive. However, when that N2 is converted to other forms of nitrogen, they become biologically, chemically, and physically active. This is a good thing in some sense because all living systems need nitrogen. But because humans are creating these forms of reactive nitrogen at a much faster rate than nature, reactive nitrogen is accumulating in the environment where it contributes to many, if not most, of the environmental impacts that humans and ecosystems are experiencing today.
So how does nature create nitrogen in the first place?
Natural systems create reactive nitrogen, that is converting inert N2 to any other form of nitrogen, which we term reactive nitrogen, by two main processes. The dominant one is biological nitrogen fixation, where microorganisms actually within the cells convert N2 into reactive nitrogen. Another important one in some regions is lightning. When lightning occurs, lots of energy is released, and the molecule N2 in the atmosphere reacts with oxygen to form nitric oxide. So that's how nature creates reactive nitrogen, and nature also converts reactive nitrogen back to N2 in the process of denitrification. So you don't have reactive nitrogen accumulating in the environment. But now humans have come along, and by three main mechanisms, they also create reactive nitrogen. First, they plant legumes, we think soybeans and peanuts, and by virtue of planting those, these are plants that act as a host for those same bacteria and microorganisms that create reactive nitrogen through biological nitrogen fixation. So they're enhancing nature's ability to create reactive nitrogen. The second one, and by far the largest on a global basis, is making of nitrogen fertilizer by the Haber-Bosch process, where under high temperatures and pressures, the molecule N2 and the molecule H2, hydrogen, are reacted to form ammonia. Then the third one is combustion of fossil fuels, and you convert N2 in the atmosphere with oxygen over to nitric oxide.
Something that you've come up with to describe and explain the real kind of problem that nitrogen is having is with your nitrogen cascade. What is this, and how does this show the effects of nitrogen and how it's amplifying?
The nitrogen cascade is that one atom of reactive nitrogen created by humans can cascade through the environmental systems, contributing in turn to each of those impacts. And so imagine a molecule of nitric acid, a molecule of nitric oxide that is emitted from a car's tailpipe that is emitted into the atmosphere, where it can cause ozone concentrations to increase, which contribute to smog. That molecule of nitrogen, that atom of nitrogen, can be converted into a particle, which can contribute to haze. Then that atom of nitrogen can be taken out of the atmosphere by rain and snow, acidifying the rain and snow in the process, which will then acidify soils and streams and lakes. And then as the same atom of nitrogen moves through the environmental system, it's transported in rivers to coastal environments, where it acts as an over-enriching nutrient and can cause oxygen losses from coastal environments, leading to dead zones. And then again, the same atom of nitrogen can be converted to a gas called nitrous oxide, which is two atoms of nitrogen and one atom of oxygen, which would be emitted to the atmosphere, and it's a greenhouse gas, so it contributes to global climate change. And then the same atom of nitrogen, again in the form of nitrous oxide, can diffuse into the stratosphere, contributing to stratospheric ozone depletion. And so just this one creation of reactive nitrogen in the form of nitric oxide cascades through all the environmental systems.
So what are the proposed solutions? How can we achieve this balance?
The most obvious is, since when reactive nitrogen is formed during combustion of fossil fuels, that's formed by accident. We don't need that reactive nitrogen. And so we have the technology, we know the science, we have the public policy instruments, and in some countries the laws, to decrease the amount of reactive nitrogen emitted to the atmosphere from fossil fuel combustion. So that's simple to do, technically. Another way, on the food production system, is we can make crops more efficient in taking up reactive nitrogen. Currently, of all the reactive nitrogen in the form of nitrogen fertilizer put on croplands, only about 30 to 50% is taken up by the crop. The rest is lost to the environment. The same can be said about animals. The world consumes a lot of meat. Animals need nitrogen just like crops, just like people, but we can make the feeding of animals more efficient. We can have a better mixture of amino acids in the animal feed so that more of the nitrogen that enters the animal's mouth stays with the animal instead of coming out the other end.
So those are some possible solutions to ease the problem, but as individuals, we can play our part too, by eating less meat and reducing our fossil fuel consumption. That was James Galloway from the University of Virginia, explaining how the increasing levels of reactive nitrogen in our atmosphere is damaging our environment. You're listening to the Chemistry World podcast with me, Meera Senthilingam. And still to come, we discover the benefits of spicing up your life, reveal a new, greener form of battery, and discover a new chemical bond that could not only help treat good pastures syndrome, but also give us an insight into the entire animal kingdom. But first, keeping on the topic of nitrogen, Tom, you found out about another way this element is affecting our atmosphere.
Yeah, that's right. This is a study that's been undertaken by A.R. Ravi Shankara and his colleagues who are from NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Research Center, and they're at Colorado in the USA. They've published a study in Science, the main point being that nitrous oxide, which is N2O, is now thought to be the main contributory factor to the depletion of the ozone layer, and it will remain in that status for the rest of this century.
Why is nitrous oxide now the concern, and how has it kind of overtaken other potential worries about chemicals that affect the ozone?
It basically seems that it's been overlooked in the past to some extent, and that's because most of the focus has been on the CFCs and also the HCFCs. CFCs are chlorofluorocarbons, and the HCFCs are the hydrochlorofluorocarbons. It was really in the sort of later years of the last century, the 1980s, where pictures of the ozone layer showed that there was a big hole there, and this kind of raised the issue in the public consciousness. And then as a result of that, the Montreal Protocol was formulated in 1987. So this banned use of the CFCs, which at the time were the most destructive chemicals depleting the ozone layer. The HCFCs were then introduced as temporary replacements for the CFCs. They're also harmful towards the ozone layer, but not as much as the CFCs. So that really is why no one has looked particularly at nitrous oxide. This group has run the computational simulation or a model which shows that now N2O is the main chemical depleting the ozone layer.
How is this nitrous oxide created by human activity, and what effect does it actually have on our ozone? Why does it damage our ozone?
There are both natural and man-made sources, and I think actually natural sources are still more important than man-made nitrous oxide. So depends on which information source you look at, but roughly 30% of the nitrous oxide which ends up in the stratosphere comes from man-made sources. Of this, the largest single source is nitrate fertilizers used for agriculture, and then it ends up as nitrogen oxides in the atmosphere. And then these nitrogen oxides react with ozone, thus depleting it.
But just how big a problem is nitrous oxide? So what levels are we looking at here of it in our atmosphere?
Well, what they've done, they've calculated something called the ODP, which is the ozone depleting potential. Nitrous oxide has a similar ODP to some of the HCFCs.
Okay, so everyone needs to do their bit to help the environment as well. And one way we could do this in the future is by using paper batteries. So what are these about, James?
Well, these are metal-free rechargeable batteries. And as you say, they're made largely from paper. And the advantage that they have over current batteries is that they can be made extremely thin, and they can also be made flexible. So you could even consider rolling them up to increase the sort of density of power that they can hold. This is some research that's come out of Uppsala University in Sweden, and it's basically two research groups that were working on quite different sounding things. One group were looking at conducting organic polymers. So these are long chain organic molecules which have lots of double bonds in, so they can conduct electrons along the backbone of the molecule. And the other group were looking at cellulose produced by a particular kind of algae. And this cellulose has a quite a unique nanostructure. It has an extremely high surface area. It's extremely rough surface on the nanoscale. So what these groups have done is get together and basically coat the cellulose with this conducting polymer, and they found that that makes a really effective electrode. That was work that they'd done a little while ago. What they've done now is put two of those electrodes together, separated by a sheet of filter paper that's just been soaked in some salty water, and discovered that that works as quite an effective battery.
Although it may work as a battery, just what kind of figures are we looking at into the actual voltage and the power that these batteries create?
In terms of the capacity, it's quite a lot lower than the lithium-ion batteries that we all have in our laptops and mobile phones these days. I think they've done 1,000 cycles of charging and discharging and shown that they do have quite a long life. They work in quite a similar way to lithium-ion batteries, but it's the chloride ions from the salty water that actually transfers from one electrode to the other. So they flow in one direction when it's discharging, and then are sort of pumped back the other way when the batteries are being charged up.
So due to this flexibility and their thinness, what are the potential uses then of these batteries?
Well, also quite lightweight as well, so you can imagine incorporating them into clothing to power all sorts of devices. The authors even suggest that they could be impregnated into wallpaper to power, I don't know, goodness knows what, your wall clock or something. And they also talked about putting them into packaging, powering sort of active displays on things like medicines, for example, could be quite beneficial.
So we could soon see models with lights flashing all down them as they walk down the catwalk and have light designs covering our walls. Thanks, James. Now, spices such as garlic, cinnamon, chili are an acquired taste. There are some of us that put them in everything we cook or boast about how much of things like chili we can handle in our food. And there are others that just can't stand them. But nutritionists have been studying these spices for many years now, and have found a variety of benefits of these spices on our health. One such scientist is Jaya Henry from Oxford Brookes University, and he's identified his top three spices in terms of their health benefits. So I spoke to him to find out what these spices are. And at number three, we have cinnamon.
Well, it turns out that cinnamon in recent years has been shown repeatedly from different laboratories that it has a very unique property of modulating your blood glucose. And in other words, many people around the world are diabetic, which is, as you know, a way in which your blood glucose levels are not very well controlled. So you have what is called hyperglycemia. And the common intervention is to either provide insulin or some tablets that cause you to reduce your blood glucose. Now, it is quite challenging that people have noticed from the time of the Vedic period, which goes back, as you know, millennia, that cinnamon has an effect on what they called at that time sugar problems. And I think they were quite clever in articulating that. But recent studies, both from America and from Europe, have shown that, yes, providing cinnamon as a powder form in food appears to have a moderate effect on your blood glucose. And I think that's a very exciting observation.
Now, what is the actual compound in the cinnamon that has this effect on the body, and how does it work?
Well, I think those two questions have still not been resolved. I think the analytical chemistry is still up on speed, but also we do not know whether it actually stimulates insulin production, which is what the speculation has been. As you know, there are compounds that are available in the market, pharmacological, that stimulate insulin production by the pancreas. So therefore, it could well be that we are now on a starting of a journey. So at the moment, it's what I would call an observational study. So the next stage will be the analytical chemistry to identify the particular compound.
Now then, moving up your ranks to number two is turmeric. So what is it about turmeric that's beneficial to the human body?
Well, turmeric has been used for centuries, certainly in India, as an excellent antimicrobial and a kind of antiseptic. And in India, especially young women and women who have just had a bath, they normally have their face garnished with turmeric because it actually gets rid of your pimples and the acne and all the microbes that are surrounding it. But the more recent exciting observation is that it may have an effect on reducing the amyloid formation in your brain cells, so that it reduces the risk of becoming demented. One form of dementia in Alzheimer's due to amyloid formation of the proteins in your brain. And it turns out that turmeric has some way in which it actually mechanistically stops that amyloid formation, reduces your risk of gaining dementia, which today has been labeled as a major public health issue around the world.
So what is the compound within this turmeric that's having this dual effect then?
The compound that has been identified is called curcumin, which is also a very powerful antioxidant. And as we speak, there's also a clinical trial using it as a therapeutic intervention for anti-cancer agents. So it is quite a fascinating compound in terms of its multiple attributes to health and well-being.
Now, the spice at the top of your list, having benefits for the human body, is a particular spice that I myself love, and that's garlic, which you've been quoted as saying that if you could only eat one spice in every food that you eat and nothing else, it would be garlic. So why is garlic so great that it has the best benefits above everything else?
Garlic contains a group of thiocyanates, and it turns out that it has got even more than turmeric, a kind of a multifaceted attributes. It certainly is also antibactericide, reduces your cholesterol, improves your digestion. We also know that it has got very unusual properties as an anti-cancer agent. the lists are infinite in terms of its potential. But I think these four are quite important in that these are issues that surround many of us in terms of our day-to-day lives. And so therefore, it has got in one single package, as it were, these various attributes that are going to improve the quality of your life.
So, I mean, there are a variety of foods now that have been found to be very beneficial.
Yeah.
So to what degree should someone spice up their life then, as opposed to incorporating all these other good foods?
Well, I think spicing up life will be like turbocharging your engine. I mean, you know, your engine is in good form, but by putting this, you're sort of turbocharging your life expectancy. By adding these compounds, you're going to double your advantage.
Speaking of spicing up life, there's one particular spice we've forgotten about, and that's chili, which you've actually found has had certain effects in controlling your weight.
Some years ago, we showed that eating a few grams of chili sauce increases your metabolic rate, or what we call diet-induced thermogenesis. So if you think about it, if you eat food and the food that you eat is partly burnt off as what you call dissipated energy, you'll have less energy to store as adipose tissue. So our proposal has been that if you eat small amounts of chili sauce or chili in your food, it burns up part of your excess energy and therefore leaves you with less energy for storage as adipose tissue. So in terms of your strategy, eating spiced up food will not only spice up your life, but also spice up your body weight in terms of keeping it under shape.
But to what degree do you think this has a strong effect in controlling someone's weight? I mean, I'm assuming someone can't just stop doing exercise and start eating
nuts. Absolutely. Just to give you a simple equation, if you eat only 50 calories per day, that will turn out to be 1,500 calories per month, which turns out to be about half a kilo per month in terms of your excess body weight consumption. And if you eat this spiced up food, especially chili, it will burn up about 70 calories extra per day. And you can now work out the stoichiometry, which says that actually that 50 calories that you had to get rid of, you're now getting rid of by just eating this food. So in terms of sort of small quantum changes that makes a big difference, this has got an important attribute.
So basically, eating a curry on a regular basis could be a good idea. And maybe adding a touch of cinnamon to that next latte. That was Jaya Henry from Oxford Brookes University, explaining the benefits of spicing up your menu. When many of us think of collagen, we think cosmetics, skincare, but there are many forms of collagen, and now researchers have identified a new bond in one form of collagen which could help treat a certain autoimmune disease, as well as tell us a lot about the animal kingdom as a whole. Is that right, Phil?
Yes, Mira. Billy Hudson from Vanderbilt University in Tennessee has been studying collagen 4 for 25 years, and he's just managed to pin down exactly the bond that holds the whole thing together. It's a completely new bond that's never been seen before in any kind of biological molecule. It's a nitrogen-sulfur double bond. It's called a sulfilamine.
Just for the basics, first of all, what's collagen 4 and what role does it play in animals?
Okay, well, collagen 4 is a particular kind of collagen. We've all heard of collagen for sort of cosmetic implants, and they put it in creams and everything now. But there are lots and lots of different kinds of collagen that have different functions around the body. Collagen 4 is particularly used in the basement membranes, which form the scaffolding that tissues are built up on top of.
How important is this newly found double bond in this collagen structure?
Because it's kind of the basic scaffolding that all tissues are built on, knowing how it's held together is very important. But there's also a disease called Good Pasture syndrome where our own antibodies attack the collagen structure. So collagen 4 has a tail group which is made up of spiraled collagen tails and a head group protein. Two of these head group proteins are held together by this new sulfilamine bond. But if that bond is not present, which it is in Good Pasture syndrome, that those head groups aren't held together quite so well, and an antibody can get in, bind to those head groups and cause an immune response, which is what the disease is about. The body starts then attacking the basement membrane.
Do they know how this sulfilamine bond actually forms?
Well, not for sure, but Professor Hudson thinks that it's formed by an enzyme, which would fit with the whole Good Pastures syndrome model, because it would be possible that patients affected by Good Pastures are either missing that enzyme or it's been disabled in some way.
So is the kind of main benefit of understanding this bond in targeting Good Pasture syndrome, or are there other benefits as well?
Well, yes. The collagen 4 dimer structure has been implicated in certain cancers as well. So there's possibility of looking at treating those. But also when you find something that's as widespread as this, I mean, Professor Hudson has got undergraduates from Vanderbilt University looking at tissues from all different kinds of animals. And so far, they've found them in pretty much everything from sea sponges upwards.
So if they're present in all of these animals, they must obviously play a very important role. And so understanding them is crucial.
Absolutely. And also, now that this new bond's been identified, the possibility exists that it can be found in other biomolecules. We know what we're looking for now.
Well, moving away from animal bonds now to the world of catalysts, where a potential new use has been found, or a new location for catalysts that could be very useful, James.
That's right, Mira, and that's within MOFs, metal organic frameworks. Basically, what they are is big lattices where basically the corners of the lattice are a metal, and these are held together by organic arms and in a repeating unit. So basically, it's a big porous cage-like structure. So we've talked about gas storage and separation for these type of structures, but now people want to start doing a little bit more than that and making molecules that get absorbed into the structure, actually sort of doing some chemistry on them. To do that, a good way is to incorporate catalysts. People have tried to incorporate catalysts directly into these sort of organic arms that hold the structure together, but that can compromise the basic structure.
So how have they managed to now get a catalyst involved?
Well, what they've done is incorporated amine groups, a nitrogen-bearing group, into these organic arms, and that basically serves as a chemical handle and that you can then attach the catalyst to. So they've sort of done it in a two-stage process. They've reacted those amines with cyclic anhydrides, and that basically pops open the cycle and leaves two oxygen-bearing arms free, and then they can chelate to a metal, and it's the metal that is actually the active part of the catalyst. What they've now done is just sort of a proof of concept aldol carbon-carbon bond-forming reaction to show that this structure is catalytically active. So you basically flow some reactants in and get the product out the other side.
So now that they've proved that this is possible and they understand it, how can it be made even better?
The speculation is that you might be able to incorporate multiple catalysts into the same MOF. So basically you'd flow in a starting material and get quite a complex product out the other end. A lot of what these have been used for in the past is for storing carbon dioxide. There's a lot of talk about separating carbon dioxide out of flue gases of power stations, that sort of thing. And so if you could sort of absorb that carbon dioxide into the MOF selectively and then do some sort of reactions with it to turn it into something useful rather than just pumping it underground and hoping it stays there, that would be obviously a great thing to be able to do. So that's a way off, but it's going in the right direction.
Thanks, James. Now that's pretty much it for this month. But before we go, it's time to catch up with the answer to last month's chemical conundrum. So what was the question again, James?
Well, it was all to do with brain chemistry. A group of scientists studying the brain had found a way to erase fearful memories in rats, and we wanted to know how had they done it.
And the answer was by manipulating their dopamine receptors. So dopamine is a neurotransmitting molecule that we all have in our brains, and what the group found was that if they block the dopamine receptors exactly 12 hours after scaring the rats, then they quickly forgot what it was that had scared them. But instead, if they give a chemical which promotes the activity of dopamine, that created a very long-lasting fear in the rats. And the timing is also very crucial. If you give the same treatment after 9 hours or 24 hours after scaring the rats, then you don't get the same kind of memory build-up.
Now, what have you got as a conundrum this month, James?
Well, this month's conundrum is about the chemistry of bread making. L-cysteine is often added to dough to speed up the rising process when you're making bread. Until 2001, when a synthetic route to L-cysteine was invented, L-cysteine came from a quite intriguing source, and we want you to tell us what that was.
And what enticing prizes do you have in the Chemistry World goodie bag to entice people into answering?
Well, appropriately enough, we've got a book on bread chemistry, but we've also been having a lot of fun in the office putting together a visual elements periodic table jigsaw. So we've got one of those jigsaws to give away.
And how do people go about entering?
They need to send the answer to chemistryworld@rse.org, and don't forget to include your address.
And you can, of course, also use that address to send us your thoughts, feedback or suggestions for future episodes. That's it for this month, but make sure to join us next month for more of the top stories from the world of chemistry. Contributors this month were James Mitchell Crowe, Bibiana Camposeo, Phil Broadwith, and Tom Bond. I'm Meera Senthilingam from thenakedscientist.com, and see you next month.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.